Bligh, upon Oliphant's return to Half Moon Street, followed him upstairs to the door of the study.
"May I come in for a moment, sir?"
Locking the door behind them with his own key, Bligh crossed to a miniature parquet bureau that supported Oliphant's smoking things. Unsealing the top of a humidor, he reached inside and removed a squat little cylinder of black japanned tin.
"This was brought round to the kitchen door by a young man, sir. He wouldn't give his name when asked. I took the liberty of opening it myself, sir, recalling some of the more heathen attempts abroad."
Oliphant took the canister and unscrewed its lid. Perforated telegraph tape.
"And the young man?"
"A junior engine clerk, sir, to judge by the state of his shoes. Aside from the fact that he wore a clerk's cotton gloves, which he didn't remove."
"And there was no message?"
"There was, sir. Tell him," he said, "that we can do no more. There is great danger. He mustn't ask again."
"I see. Would you mind bringing up a pot of strong green tea?"
Alone, Oliphant set about removing the heavy glass from his personal receiving telegraph, a matter of loosening four brass wing screws. Placing the tall, vitrine-like dome out of harm's way, he spent some minutes consulting the maker's instructional manual. After rummaging through several drawers, he located the requisite implements, a walnut-handled brass hand crank and a small gilt screwdriver embossed with the monogram of the Colton Maxwell Company. He located the knife switch at the base of the instrument and severed the electrical connection with the post office. He then used the screwdriver to make the necessary adjustments, carefully threaded the end of the tape onto the bright steel sprockets, locked the guide plates into position, and took a deep breath. He was all at once aware of the beating of his own heart, and of the night's silence pressing in from the darkness of Green Park, and of the eye. He took up the crank, thrust its hexagonal tip into the mechanism's socket, and began steadily but slowly to turn it clockwise. The character hammers began to rise and fall, deciphering the punch code of the post office tape. He refused to look at it as it emerged from the slot. It was done. With scissors and paste pot, he assembled the message on a sheet of foolscap. "Dear Charles, 9 years ago you put me to the worst dishonour that a woman can know, stop. Charles, you promised me that you would save my poor father, stop. Instead, you corrupted me, body and soul, stop. Today I am leaving London, in the company of powerful friends, stop. They know very well what a traitor you were to Walter Gerard, and to me, stop. Do not attempt to find me, Charles, stop. It would be useless, stop. I do hope that you and Mrs. Egremont will sleep soundly tonight, stop. Sybil Gerard." End it. Only barely aware of Bligh arriving with the tea, he sat unmoving for the better part of an hour, the message before him. Then, after pouring himself a cup of lukewarm tea, he gathered stationery, took out his reservoir pen, and began to compose, in his flawless diplomat's French, a letter to a certain Monsieur Arslo of Paris. Flash powder still stank in the air. The Prince Consort turned, with his full Teutonic gravity, from an elaborate stereo-optic camera of Swiss manufacture, and greeted Oliphant in German. He wore aquamarine spectacles, their circular lenses no larger than florins, and was draped in a photographer's smock of spotless white duck. His fingers were stained with silver nitrate. Oliphant bowed, wishing His Highness a good afternoon in what amounted to the royal family's language of choice, and pretended to examine the Swiss camera, an intricate creation whose stereoptic lenses, like eyes, stared from beneath a smooth brass brow. Like the eyes of Mr. Cart, the consort's muscular Swiss valet, they struck Oliphant as being set rather too widely apart.
"I've brought Afi a little gift, Your Highness," Oliphant said. His German, like the Prince Consort's, had the accent of Saxony, the legacy of a prolonged and delicate mission Oliphant had undertaken there at the behest of the royal family. Prince Albert's Coburg relatives, ever ingenious at the ancient craft of marriage politics, were eager to expand their tiny domain. A delicate matter indeed, when the policy of the British Foreign Office was to keep the German mini-states as fragmented as politically possible.
"Has the young prince concluded his day's lessons?"
"Afi is ill today,"
Albert said, peering through his tinted spectacles at one of the camera's lenses. He produced a small brush and lightly whisked at the surface of the lens. He straightened.
"Do you think the study of statistics too much a burden for a tender young mind?"
"My opinion, Your Highness," Oliphant said. "Statistical analysis is indeed a powerful technique."
"His mother and I disagree on the matter," the prince confided mournfully, "and Alfred's progress in the subject is far from satisfactory. Nevertheless, statistics is the key to the future. Statistics are everything in England."
"Does he progress well in his other studies?" Oliphant hedged.
"Anthropometry," the prince suggested absently. "Eugenics. Powerful fields of learning, but less taxing, perhaps, to the youthful brain."
"Perhaps I might have a word with him, Your Highness," Oliphant said. "I know the lad means well."
"He is in his room, no doubt," the prince said.
Oliphant met his way through the draughty glamour of the royal apartments to Alfred's room, where he was greeted with a whoop of glee, the prince scrambling in bare feet from mounded bedclothes and hopping nimbly across the tracks of a most elaborate miniature railway.
"Uncle Larry! Uncle Larry! Brilliant! What have you brought for me?"
"Baron Zorda's latest!"
In Oliphant's pocket, wrapped in green tissue and smelling strongly of cheap, fresh ink, was a copy of Paternoster the Steam Bandit by one Baron Zorda, the third volume in the popular series, young Prince Alfred having expressed his unbridled enthusiasm for the two previous numbers, The Skeleton Army and Wheelmen of the Tsar. The book's garishly coloured cover depicted the daring Paternoster, pistol in hand, climbing from the cabin of a hurtling vehicle one took to be a gurney in the latest style, sheathed in tin, bulbous at the prow and very narrow in the rear. The frontispiece, which Oliphant had examined in the Piccadilly newsagents where he had purchased the volume, offered Baron Zorda's raffish highwayman in rather more detail, particularly in regard to his dress, which included a broad belt of studded leather and bell-bottomed trousers with buttoned vents at the cuffs.
"Super!"
The boy eagerly tore the green tissue from Paternoster the Steam Bandit.
"Look at his gurney, Uncle Larry! It's line-streamed like 60.
"Nothing but the swiftest for wicked Paternoster, have he? And see the frontispiece. He's got up like Smash-Jaw Ned."
"Look at his narrow go-wides," Alfred said admiringly, "and his bloody great belt."
"And how have you been, Affy?"
Oliphant asked, ignoring the boy's lapse in language, "since my last visit."
"Very well, Uncle Larry,"
and a shadow of anxiety crossed the young face.
"But I'm afraid she's broken, you see."
The prince pointed to where the Japanese tea-doll slumped disconsolately against the foot of the massive four-poster, surrounded by a tumbled sea of lithographed tin and painted lead. A long, sharp sliver of some translucent material protruded grotesquely from her gorgeous robe.
"It's the spring, you see. I think it was wound too tightly, Uncle Larry. It sprang right out on the 10th turn."
"The Japanese power their dolls with springs of baleen, Affy. Whale whiskers, they call the stuff. They haven't yet learned from us the manufacture of proper springs, but soon they shall. When they do, their dolls shan't break so easily."
"Father says you're too keen on your Japanese," Alfred said. "He says you think them the equal of Europeans."
"And I do, Affy. Their mechanical appliances are presently inferior, due to their lack of knowledge in the applied sciences. Some day, in futurity, they may lead civilization to heights yet untold. They, and perhaps the Americans..."
The boy regarded him dubiously.
"Father wouldn't like that at all. What you said?"
"No, I rather doubt he would."
Oliphant then spent half an hour down on his knees upon the carpet, watching Alfred demonstrate a toy French engine, operated, as was its cousin the great Napoleon, by compressed air. The little engine employed lengths of telegraph tape rather than cards, reminding Oliphant of his letter to Monsieur Arslo. Bligh would have taken it round to the French embassy by now. Very likely it was already on its way to Paris by diplomatic pouch. Alfred was connecting his engine to a miniature kinetrope. There came a ceremonious rattle at the doorknob. The doors of Buckingham Palace were never knocked. Oliphant rose and opened the tall, white portal to discover the well-known face of Nash, a palace valet de chambre, whose unwise speculations in railway shares had briefly made him the unwilling intimate of the Metropolitan Fraud Bureau. Oliphant's politesse had successfully smoothed the matter, a kindness well invested, he saw now, by Nash's unfeigned air of respectful attention.
"Mr. Oliphant," Nash announced, "a telegram has come, sir. Most urgent."
The velocity of the special branch vehicle contributed in no small part to Oliphant's general sense of unease. Paternoster himself could have asked for nothing faster, or more radically line-streamed. They flew past St. James's Park with the speed of dream, the bare black branches of the lime trees flashing by like wind-driven smoke. The driver wore leather goggles with round lenses, and plainly relished their headlong flight, periodically sounding a deep-throated whistle that sent horses rearing and pedestrians scurrying. The stoker, a burly young Irishman, was grinning maniacally as he shoveled coke into the burner. Oliphant had no idea of their destination. Now, as they neared Trafalgar, the traffic caused the driver to yank the whistle cord continually, steadily, setting up a mournful, bellowing ululation, like the grief of some marine behemoth. The traffic at this sound parted like the Red Sea before Moses. Helmeted policemen saluted smartly as they sped past. Urchins and crossing sweepers turned cartwheels of delight at the sight of a sleek tin fish racketing down the strand. The evening had grown quite dark. As they entered Fleet Street, the driver applied the brake and worked a lever that released a mighty gout of uprushing steam. The line-streamed gurney bumped to a halt.
"Well, sir,"
the driver commented, raising his goggles to peer through the fretted glass of the vehicle's prow,
"would you look at that?"
Traffic, Oliphant saw, had been halted completely by the erection of wooden barricades hung with lanterns. Behind these stood grim-faced soldiers in combat drab, Cutts Maudsley carbines unslung and at the ready. Beyond them he saw sheets of canvas loosely hung from raw timber uprights, as though someone were attempting to erect stage scenery in the middle of Fleet Street. The stoker swabbed his face with a polka-dot Kingsman.
"Something here the press aren't meant to see."
"They've put it in the wrong street, then," the driver said, "haven't they?"
As Oliphant climbed from the gurney, Fraser came walking quickly toward him.
"We found her," Fraser said glumly.
"And seem to have attracted considerable publicity in the process. Perhaps a few less infantry would be in order."
"It isn't a matter for levity, Mr. Oliphant. You'd best come with me."
"Is Betteridge here?"
"Haven't seen him. This way, please."
Fraser led the way between a pair of barricades. A soldier curtly nodded them past. Oliphant glimpsed a mustachioed gentleman in urgent conversation with two metropolitans.
"That's Halliday," he said, "Chief of Criminal Anthropometry."
"Yes, sir," Fraser said. "They're all over this one. The Museum of Practical Geology has been broken into. The Royal Society is angry as a nest of hornets, and Bloody Egremont will be in every first edition, calling it a Luddite outrage. Our only bit of luck would seem to be that Dr. Mallory is well away in China."
"Mallory? Why is that?"
"The Land Leviathan. Mrs. Bartlett and her cohorts attempted to make away with the thing's skull."
They rounded one of the makeshift barriers, its coarse fabric stamped at intervals with a broad arrow mark of the Army Ordnance Department. A cab horse lay on its side in a great pool of darkening blood. The cab, a common one-horse fly, was overturned nearby, its dull, black lacquered panels stitched with bullet holes.
"She was with two men," Fraser said. "Three, if you count a corpse they left behind in the museum. The hack was driven by a Yankee exile called Russell, a bully rock bruiser living in Seven Dials. The other man was Henry Dees of Liverpool, quite the accomplished cracksman. I'd hire Henry and Doc 10 times when I was on the force, but no more. They're laid out there, sir," he pointed. "Russell, the driver, evidently got into a shouting match with a real cabman over who should give way. A metropolitan on traffic duty attempted to intervene, at which point Russell produced a pistol."
Oliphant was staring at the overturned cab.
"The traffic officer was unarmed, but a pair of Bow Street detectives happened to be passing."
"But this cab, Fraser?"
"That's the work of an army gurney, sir. The last of the temporary garrisons is just by the Holborn Viaduct."
He paused.
"Dees had a Russian shotgun."
Oliphant shook his head in disbelief.
8 civilians taken to hospital," Fraser said. 1 detective dead. But come along, sir. Best we get this done with."
"What is the meaning of these canvas screens?"
"Criminal anthropometry ordered them."
Oliphant felt as though he were moving through a dream, his limbs numb and without volition. He allowed himself to be led to where 3 canvas-draped bodies were arranged upon stretchers. The face of Florence Bartlett was a hideous ruin.
"Vitriol," Fraser said. "A bullet shattered whatever container she employed."
Oliphant turned quickly away, retching into his handkerchief.
"Sorry, sir," Fraser said. "No point in you seeing the other two."
"Betteridge. Fraser, have you seen him?"
"No, sir. Here's the skull, sir." Or what remains of it?
The skull? Perhaps half a dozen massive fragments of petrified bone and ivory-tinted plaster were neatly arranged atop a varnished trestle table.
"There's a Mr. Reeks here from the museum come to take it back," Fraser said. "Says it isn't as badly damaged as we might think. Would you like to sit down, sir? I could find you a folding stool."
"No. Why does there seem to be fully half of criminal anthropometry about, Fraser?"
"Well, sir, you're in a better position to determine that than I," Fraser said, lowering his voice, "though I've heard it said that Mr. Egremont and Lord Galton have recently discovered they've much in common."
"Lord Galton? The eugenics theorist?
Lord Darwin's cousin, that is. He's anthropometry's man in the House of Lords. Has a deal of influence in the Royal Society."
Fraser brought out his notebook.
"You'd best see why I thought it urgent you come here, sir."
He led Oliphant back around the ruin of the cab. Glancing about for possible observers, he passed Oliphant a fold of blue flimsy.
"I took it from the Bartlett woman's reticule."
The note was undated. Unsigned. "That which you so persistently desire has been located, albeit in a most peculiar hiding place. I am informed by our mutual acquaintance of the Derby, Dr. Mallory, that it has been sealed up within the skull of his land leviathan. I would hope that you will consider this crucial intelligence a full repayment of all my debts to you. I am in some peril now from recent political developments, and certainly I am observed by elements of government. Pray consider that in any future attempt to communicate. I have done all that I can, I swear it." The elegant hand, as familiar to Oliphant as it was to Fraser, was Lady Ada Byron's.
"The two of us alone have seen that," Fraser said.
Oliphant folded the paper in quarters before putting it away in his cigar case.
"And what exactly was it, Fraser, that was hidden in the skull?" "I'll escort you back through the line, sir."
Reporters surged forward as Fraser and Oliphant emerged from the barricades. Fraser took Oliphant's arm and led him into a cluster of helmeted metropolitans, some of whom he greeted casually by name.
"To answer your question, Mr. Oliphant,"
Fraser said, the policemen walling off the shouting crowd behind blue serge and brass buttons.
"I don't know. But we have it."
"You do? By whose authority?"
"None but my own lights," Fraser said. "Harris here, he found it in the cab, before anthropometry arrived."
Fraser very nearly smiled.
"The boys on the force aren't too keen on anthropometry. Bloody-minded amateurs, aye, Harris?"
"Aye, sir," said a metropolitan with blonde side whiskers. "They are that."
"Where is it, then?" Oliphant asked.
"Here, sir."
Harris produced a cheap black satchel.
"Just as we found it, in this."
"Mr. Oliphant, sir, I think you'd best take that straight away," Fraser said.
"Indeed, Fraser, I agree. Tell the special branch chap in the fancy gurney that I won't be needing him. Thank you, Harris. Good evening." The policemen parted smoothly. Oliphant, satchel in hand, strode smartly out through the throng, who jostled for a better view of the soldiers and the canvas screens.
"Pardon, Gov, but could you spare a copper?"
Oliphant looked down into the squinting brown eyes of Little Boots, every inch the crippled jockey. He was neither. Oliphant threw him a penny. Boots caught it adroitly, then edged forward on his cut-down crutch. He stank of damp fustian and smoked mackerel.
"Trouble, Guff. Becky'll tell you."
Boots wheeled about on his crutch and hobbled determinedly away, muttering as he went, a beggar intent upon finding a better pitch. He was one of Oliphant's two most talented watchers. The other, Becky Dean, kept pace beside Oliphant as he neared the corner of Chancery Lane. She was gotten up as a rather successful tart, brass-heeled and brazen.
"Where has Betteridge got to?"
Oliphant asked, as if talking to himself.
"Taken," Becky Dean said, "not 3 hours ago."
"Taken by whom?"
"Two men in a hack. They've been following you. Betteridge got onto them, then set us to watching the watches."
"I knew nothing of this."
"Day before yesterday, he came to us."
"And who were these men?"
"One's a greasy little ponce of a private detective. Velasco, his name is. The other was government, by the look of him."
"He was taken in broad daylight? By force?"
"You know well enough how it's done,"
Becky Dean said.